aerodynamically, how is the base of the antenna connected to the sheet metal of the car? So what was the length of the radiator, and how was it connected to the sheet metal of the car electronically? Go ahead, Glenn.
Oh boy, this was so many years ago. I think we're going back to like 78 here. I got to put my thinking cap on. If I remember correctly, it was a standard CB type of antenna, and you unwrap the coil, and I think the antenna had to be cut down from whatever. I think that they called out a 5/8 wave CB antenna, and I believe the length was either 36 or 39 inches. I don't remember off the top of my head. And they gave you on the coil form that these things were at, basically how you could put a certain number of turns on the bottom. And I think from the ground ring, there was like a turn and a half, and then there was like maybe another 7 or 8 turns you came up to the top where you soldered that on. And it was a little matching transformer, and then you could basically use any one of the mounts, the CB, basic popular, you know, PL259 type screw-on mounts that they had at the time. They could have been anything from mag mounts to, you know, the other mounts. You know, they would screw onto the chassis, trunk mounts, etc., that were available in those type of antennas back in those years in the late 70s. So that was the basic construction that...
Yeah, but you take an antenna designed for 27 megs with materials that are appropriate for 27 megs, and you move up to 146 megs on much higher frequency, certain materials become very lossy in a very subtle way. Lost tangent type stuff. That's a possible factor. The way the antenna was wound, and you unwound some of the turns, but you still got it on this lossy material. See, what happens on, you take for instance the very early rubber duck antennas, they were wound out of nichrome wire. Because the average guy could measure standing wave ratio of the antenna, he could not measure radiation efficiency. So by making the rubber duck out of nichrome, a lossy material, you got a good boudoir across the band. And when you started insisting that they make it out of a copper-coated steel or whatever, highly conductive materials, it now became a lot more difficult to match the rubber duck to the handy-talkie. You go to any one of the flea markets that we go to, and you say, I own an Icon so-and-so or a Kenwood so-and-so handy-talkie, and I want a rubber duck. I want to buy a rubber duck antenna, and he asks you what radio brand name and what model number, not just so that the connector will match. It's because each individual manufacturer has come up with his own impedance matching technique to that particular rubber duck, and some of those rubber ducks are electronically longer and shorter in order to match that particular output network of the final stage of the transmitter of that handy-talkie. So there's more going on there than meets the eye, and some of that may have happened in this particular case, but you don't have that antenna around in order to make measurements on. That would be a fun antenna to pour some power into it and look at it with a thermal imaging camera. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
NG2B.
I know where you're coming from, Dick, about that, but I said I just know that from using these antennas that the patterns that came off of them were really, I think there's a lot to be said about a lot of the mounts of these antennas. And there are tons of them out there, and you plug on different ones, and some of them will perform phenomenally on your vehicle. Other ones you plug on, and the performance is terrible. And like you're saying, it's not the efficiency, it's not the match 90% of the time. It's just really the pattern and how it's coming off the vehicle. And, you know, the most common antennas, the ones that work the best, are when you get the antenna somewhere close to the center of the roof on the car. But when you start mounting in the corners, not all antennas really perform the same way. And I think the closer you get down to quarter wave, the more critical it gets. On half wave antennas, it's not as critical. You know, like I found here with the loop, you know, granted this is not mobile at all, you know, certainly it seemed to be less affected by changes and things like that. But it just seemed like the most critical antenna to pattern and adjustment and all kinds of things just seems to be the quarter wave antenna. But it also seems to be not just in the GTEM, I mean, just in practical experience, it seems like quarter wave antennas on ground planes, if not constructed properly, can give very, very strange performance, where the half wave test center fed dipoles and loops seem to be much more predictable. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, they certainly are more forgiving. NG2B, November Golf 2 Bravo. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Very good. Hello, Dick. My name is Steve. Cool. You've got NG2B.
have been listening, and Glenn's comment about the antenna, it strikes a note with me, and I think I made a couple of those back in the late 80s. I bought some Radio Shack antennas. They were 2 meter. They were six. Excuse me. They were 11-meter antennas, and I believe the radiating section was about 24 inches. You changed the tap from about 5 turns at the base to 3 turns, but you put a 15 or 30 picofarad capacitor. I can't remember now, but I know I had to add a capacitor in there and then tuned it, and that antenna worked great. So it sounds similar to something that I had made and used. I still have a part of one of them left here in the house. It's not complete. I wish I had access to those, because they work great on 2 meters. So I'm just wondering, the question would be to Glenn, was this 24 inches or so on the radiating top section strike a bell with you, and possibly did you have to add a capacitor and change the taps at the base of the antenna? NG2B.
Very fine, Steve. Glenn, you've got it?
It sounds familiar, but 24 inches kind of sounds short to me. I remember the 10 picofarad, you reminded me about that one, the 10 picofarad variable capacitor that you had to put on the bottom in series with the center line in order to tune it. It was used as a tuning coupling capacitor. But I remember that part, but for some reason, it just seems like it was a longer antenna. I think it was the 5/8 wave that the ARRL. If somebody has an old copy of the old ARRL handbooks that they used to have back in the late 70s, it was one of the articles on antennas inside their mobile antennas, where you took a CB mobile antenna and modified it for a 2 meter antenna. I believe it was supposed to be 5/8 wave 2 meter antenna when you were done.
It was 47 inches.
You used one, Mel? Go ahead.
It's a very popular idea. It was a 47-inch antenna that was sold for CB, and you made yourself a coil and the bottom, and there was all kinds of arrangements. You mounted on a PL-259. You could use original spring mounts that came for the CB antennas. It was all kinds of ideas like that. I remember there was constant articles based on that 47-inch whip, stainless steel whip stick, and tell you the truth, most of them, I don't know, I never was very happy with any of those antennas, over.
Yeah, but you're mentioning a stainless steel whip, and these guys are talking about a helically wound 27 meg antenna, so there may have been some difference here, Mel. Go ahead.
Actually, no, Dick, I think they were all stainless steel antennas that came from Radio Shack in Lafayette at the time. That's what they called out. They were stainless steel antennas, and they performed really terribly.
Okay, Steve, though, Steve managed to make his fly. Steve, what was the magic that you had?
That was from Radio Shack. It was a base-loaded antenna, and it had a stainless steel whip on the top. I believe I had to trim the whip on the top, but I added a capacitor at the bottom. They changed the turns. I'm thinking that it was from five. It was tapped, originally without a capacitor at 5 turns, and I added a capacitor and moved it down to 3 turns. And I'll tell you, that thing was phenomenal. It worked very well. I still have part of one here, so I'll find the article somewhere along the line. I know I printed it out. I have the, and I think it was in Ham Radio. I think the original article that I had was in Ham Radio. It wasn't in the ARRL stuff. It was in Ham Radio. And I'm sure I have it here somewhere folded up in a box, NG2B.
And was your capacitor at the base of the antenna a variable capacitor that you had to adjust until you got the right performance, Steve?
Yes, that's correct. It was a small trimmer cap that was in series, tied into the coil, the base coil. It was a base load of the antenna, Dick. The antenna was base loaded, and it wasn't that long. It was pretty short little antenna. I'll tell you what, the thing worked great. It worked better than any other antenna that I've ever had for 2 meters, even the collinears. I don't know what the pattern was off of it, but I'll tell you what, it worked great. And I've always wanted to find another one of those so I could replicate it, but I haven't been able to find one. The ones that they came out with later from Radio Shack were all glued together, and I tried to take them apart, but you wound up destroying them.
I guess the band's in pretty good shape. Give me a rough idea, Steve. Where is Grahamville, New York? How far is that from New York City so I can place you? Go ahead.
Grahamville's my mailing address. That's a Sullivan County location. I live in Ulster County. I'm actually in the south central part of the Catskill Park. I'm about 15 miles from Grahamville, north-northwest of Grahamville. I'm midway between Kingston and Roscoe, if you can find those on the map, Kingston and Roscoe.
What are you using for an antenna, and how far above the ground is it, Steve?
I've got a 10-element Yagi, which is part of a 10-element Crush Yagi, Cushcraft. I've only got the vertical section put together right now. It's on top of the house, probably about 25 feet off the ground. But I'm at 2,600 feet here, Dick.
Fantastic. And you're pumping how many watts into that antenna?
Right now, about 120.
Okay, a tiny bit of noise, but you're making it. That's a nice long pass. What's your best guess as to the number of airline miles between you, Steve, and the intersection between Nassau and Suffolk County near the center of Long Island? What's your guess as to the number of miles?
Well, I haven't a clue, Dick. I don't usually talk down this way. I listen to you guys quite often on Sunday nights, but I don't usually talk. I'm thinking the city's probably about 90 miles, maybe 110 or so.
Fantastic. Okay, you're at DX station, and you ought to sign in a little more often as long as the propagation holds up. We also had another guy who signed in earlier. Maybe he's left us by now. N2SCL, I think it was. Are you still there, sir?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. I've been
very, very weak right now. Maybe a little bit further away, and maybe the propagation has changed. Unfortunately, right now, you're 60% noise and 30% signal, if you know what I mean. If you're talking to us with a handy talkie, you should try move to a slightly different position. Or if you've got a rotatable antenna, you should try moving it to a slightly different position. Or if you've got a little more power, you should try it. Want to give it another try? SCL, go ahead. Okay, automobile, Montville, New Jersey. That's a long haul. Is your call November 2, Sierra, Charlie, Lima, or do I have that call wrong? Okay, very noisy signal, I'm sorry to say. Mel, what kind of mail have you had this week? I wanted to watch 60 Minutes tonight, and unfortunately, Channel 2 was not making it. Into my fringe antenna on top of the roof of the house with brand new transmission line going to it, and the antenna itself is in very good looking shape and aimed directly at Empire State Building, and my land is 300 feet above sea level, but I get about 75% copy of TBS, unfortunately, which I think is on channel 33. The real frequency of TBS. I've got to look at my little list. Yeah, 33. And that particular signal, many of the other UHF channels are coming through beautifully, but that one just doesn't make it to my house. So when you're watching something like 60 Minutes tonight, which was the guy who landed the aircraft in the Hudson River, I can't think of his name all of a sudden, he had a beautiful interview, and just when he and all the people he worked with gave out their keywords, that's when the audio would drop out. Scully. Good old Scully. Let's see, now, we had a question for you earlier, Eric. I think it's Eric that's in there with us. I wonder if you had any confirmation or denial of what I mentioned earlier. And there was somebody with an earlier question that we're supposed to... Yeah, Joe wanted me to ask you a question. I'm having trouble remembering Joe's question.
ADO multiplex.
Yes, yes, yes. Joe was asking us about how do they do HD radio on either AM or FM radio. You might have a few words on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLIW. KQRIWK 2K. The short answer is it's a system called Ibiquity. And in essence, what they do is on the upper and lower sideband of the carrier, they actually transmit a COFDM type signal. If you look at the AM and FM stations on a spectrum analyzer, you'll see little shelves on both sides of the carrier. That's the digital portion. Does that help? Sure does. Okay. Other than that, how are things working in the digital world? And from your point of view, is it onward and upward from here? And are brighter days coming as antenna improvements are made at Empire State Building? Back to you, Eric.
You know, when they finished the construction of the UHF bay, things will get better. But, of course, there's always room for improvement in the receiver. As the receivers get better, of course, the reception will get better. They figure that ASB is a perfect signal. You know, it's a perfect transmission standard, except that the receivers just aren't up to the task yet, but they're getting there. And by the way, if you ever do get to put a rotor on your antenna, you can solve that problem. Believe it or not, 1 degree difference will make it work or not work.
I'm about to put a rotator on the antenna on the roof that's not connected to the chimney. I'm about to put a rotator on the antenna that will be mounted at the 75-foot level of tower number one. So for me, I'm going to start doing a little bit of digital television DXing. By the way, I did a quick tune across the old-fashioned analog band. I'm amazed how many signals were there today. Some of them may have been good propagation. And I saw your channel 32, the religious channel. And I saw a bunch of other channels, there's still quite a bit of low-power TV, old-fashioned analog television still in existence. I noticed that channel 4 is no longer giving you instructions, but channel 2 is still giving us instructions 24 hours a day. And I think you said it's going to go on for 30 days. So I guess we're getting very close to the end of that one, aren't we? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RWK, okay. Well, I haven't checked lately, but they were talking about them extending it because of people having their difficulty. And it is the lowest channel on dial, so it does propagate well. I don't think the FCC even knows what they're doing at this point. But the end is coming. It may not be as near as we think, but it's coming. And now is a good time for DXing, actually, for the remainder of analog stations. Most of the stuff that you'll see is going to be low power. But low power isn't required to change for another 2 years. They will have to go digital, but they get a little reprieve in terms of having to make that expense right now. Because, let's just give you a little concept of it. Like Channel 32, which is coming out of Hicksville, I'm going to go up. There's simply a tape deck there, and it goes into a little analog transmitter. The entire setup, minus the antenna, is probably around, you could probably do that for around $6,000 to $10,000, let's say. The second we start talking about digital, we need a device called an encoder. The transmitter may not actually be all that expensive, but, yeah, actually the expense does go up a lot. But you have to encode the signal into a form in which the analog transmitter can use it. And the cheapest one that I've seen lately is around $24,000 to $26,000. So right there, just to get the signal ready to go into the transmitter is an expense that you never used to have. And then the exciter itself and the transmitter, I've seen them go as cheap as like $16,000 and $20,000. So there you go. K2RIW, K2J.
In the past, the ham radio operators, the VHF, UHF ham radio operators in California, have been very progressive. Fast scan, slow scan television also has existed out there quite a bit before it became popular on the East Coast. Therefore, my question, I guess, is, have you been hearing any words about ham radio operators buying the chips for duty encoding and setting up digital television transmitting ham radio systems anywhere in the United States or anywhere in the world. Have you heard any words along those lines yet? Or am I a little ahead of the game on that one now? Eric, go ahead.
Well, in reality, about 2 years behind. The Ohio Amateur Radio Television Group, actually, they transmit COFDM. No, I'm sorry, it's QPSK. It's the same standard as the cheap satellite receiver, like you got that Pansat receiver. And the format is called DVB-S. The satellite. There's something called DVB-T, which is terrestrial. That's COFDM. That's a lot more expensive. There's a group in Germany. There's a couple of guys that took a VLSI, and one of them created an MPEG encoder, because you have to turn the video into MPEG in order for it to be seen. That's a slightly expensive proposition. But the way they did it, it's pretty cheap. I forget the name of the group, but I think it's the group in Berlin. But anyway, you do a search for digital ham TV, you'll find this stuff. And they also, with another set of VLSIs, created a encoder that conforms to the DVB-S standard. And that you can put into a power amplifier, and you can use a regular home satellite receiver like a Pansat to pick it up. K2RW, well, the Ohio group has a repeater that takes an analog on 430 FM on 1.2. They also transmit the digital on 1.2, and they got a couple, I think they got a 900 input also. K2RW, K2RW.
Now, television broadcast for backhaul right now going through satellite is, for the most part, FM modulated. I should know this. It's a pretty dumb question.
Not anymore.
Oh, I was about to ask you, the Pansat type decoder, is it taking the FM signal and then using a protocol on it? Or what is the best pipe of the satellite? You're telling me it's now sending sending a digital signal going through that traveling wave tube, an amplitude-sensitive digital signal, as opposed to the FM signal, the angular modulated signal that used to be used? Over to you, Mel. All right, here we go, Eric.
By the way, if you try to tune in an analog transponder on one of these digital satellite receivers, forget it, you get nothing, because they don't understand analog. They're either BPSK or QPSK, you get your choices, transmission standards from the satellite. And the Pansat receiver is strictly a digital device. There is no analog about it whatsoever.
Okay, if I replace the low noise amplifier that's in my 10-foot dish, my TVRO mounted at the 70-foot level of my tower and hasn't been used in a couple of years. If I replace the low-noise amplifier that's been damaged, and I now scan across those 23 S-band and 20 C-band and KU-band satellites, looking for analog, and I look for analog FM signals, are you telling me I won't find a single one, Eric, go ahead.
Well, you'll find maybe one or two per satellite, if that many. Even the ENG stuff has gone through the digital mode. But now, if you ask yourself, why can't you pick up NASA anymore?
Okay, there's my next question. One of my favorite programs used to be NASA Select. Are you telling me that with the Pansat receiver hooked up to a properly operating TVRO, until I do some other piece of hardware establishment, I will not even get the NASA Select? Back to you, Eric.
So I've been trying to tell you for the past 2 years to go buy a 3-inch, a 3-foot dish. You know, the little round things that you see for DirecTV. And actually, that's K-band. It's not KU-band. It's downshifted in frequency somewhat. Put it on, connect it to your Pansat receiver. I think you have to point it at, I don't remember whether it's 110 or 119, I look it up. Point it there, hook a little spectrum analyzer up to it so you can get the perfect signal. And then tune your satellite, your Pansat receiver to channel 213, you'll see NASA Select for free.
Okay, how many other channels will I be able to get with that Pansat?
Well, If you go to one of the sites that I give you and download a new set of software for the receiver, you can probably get everything that's on Echo Store, but that's not exactly kosher.
Understand. Okay. I got a lot of work to do. See, all these great television signals I'm missing now. Just look what you and I are missing, because we're still listening to over-the-air broadcasts, what little bit of television we do listen to. And I'm the only guy in my community that doesn't seem to be on cable TV. I'm a real dinosaur. You may be one of the very few that's in your community that's not on cable TV. And we're standouts, or we're out of the dark ages. So I hope some of the, if you're in your neighborhood of digital television grief has calmed down a little bit. And I hope those friends of yours have stopped blaming you because you can't give them the glamour fix. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Now, I stay away from the whole thing, really, Dick. I just, as they say, support. That's a good question myself from the whole system and everything, because it's still going on. And I don't know what's happening. I don't even want to know what go near the place on over there by Sheep's S.A. Day, because the poor girl that works in the office there in the assemblyman's office, I think, was ready to quit and leave the country or something, because it was continuous bedlam, to say the least. And I tried a little bit to explain, I tried a little bit to say what the situation is there, but, you know, just mentioned somebody that I'm a ham radio operator. That's what happened. One of them says, oh, Mel knows a lot about this because he's a ham radio operator.
Oh!
One of them had a chime up and says, yeah, my brother had one next door, ruined his television, and ruined the tuner, and now these are the guys that causing all this, and it's bang, bang, bang. And I said, no, that's all, stop, not some truth to it, but believe me, Dick, I just said, don't call on me anymore. It's just, this is a, as they used to say, a Gordian knot that can't be untied, over.
You know, you can tell them to call a TV station.
And what can a TV station do for them, Eric?
Yeah, well, actually, a lot of the stations have been sending people out to look at various installations. Actually, the FCC has gone on a few of them. And, believe it or not, they've been able to help some people out.
Mel, do you think if a representative from the TV station came out, is it a pilot error problem when it comes to pressing the right button on the remote control, or is the equipment itself, and for the best operator, not adequate for the particular task? K2KEY, K2RIW.
There's no magic that you're going to do in some of those spots, because I told you the L is between the is to the north of all these people, and that L, the bright line, is a problem child. Even when you get marginal, train goes by, and there's always trains coming and going, you know, to the route. So there's nothing you can do. I know they've had representatives from cable companies come out there and other ones there. I don't know who they were. I guess possibly maybe from the FCC, maybe from one of the broadcast stations. And bottom line is the place has to be cabled. Those are old buildings, and I don't know who's going to pay for cabling them. And the cable companies are not going to, you know, thread wires through the hallways, which it has to be done, put up the troughs and all that. You know, there's a lot of money involved with insurances and everything, Dick, over.
Hey, you know, cable will wire up a building if there's enough customers.
Yeah, what Mel described to us last week, Eric, is that the BMT elevated line, the Brighton line, the Brighton elevated line goes right in front of these apartment buildings, a very small number of feet away, and there's a train going by every couple of minutes, arcing and sparking, and so it's a large metallic object between them and their television reception, and it's doing a lot of arcing and sparking. So I know that sounds like a pretty difficult environment. I'm wondering, even if a roof-mounted antenna that is slightly higher than the elevated train, would it be effective in that particular circumstance? You might have an opinion on that one, Eric. K2EJ, K2RYW.
WS2N.
Paul recognized, but Eric first, right, Eric?
No, it's kind of a tough call, Dick. It really is. But I've seen places like where the L is up where the A-train goes out. Is that the A-train? No, it's the number one. There's an apartment there. And we managed to find a spot that worked pretty well. So I think it's possible, but it's a tough one.
Eric, on a quick break, I'm getting a tremendous amount of signal from you. Are you at the home QTH and you're giving me great propagation, or at your place of business?
I'm running what I always run. I'm running 10 watts. But I've got 22 circularly polarized elements pointed at you.
Why is it pointed at me? Oh, okay. To point it at the repeater, you're saying we point it at me? I can't believe that they're in, that you and the repeater and I are in line. Back to you, Eric.
Well, to be precise, it's pointed at the cell of the machine.
That makes sense. Now you're in line, I believe. Paul, what's the latest with you? And what should we know? WS2N, K2RIW?
No, I'm just thinking about all these digital boxes. I think part of the problem, a little bit of experience I've had with different boxes, converter boxes, they're all different. I mean, the quality on some is good and the other ones are bad. You know, if somebody really doesn't know anything about anything picks up one of these bad boxes, they're going to be very unhappy. The first box I picked up was a very good one by Zenith, or a converter box. That's the best one so far. I tried an RCA box after that, and that was a disaster. That went back. And now I picked up an Apex box, which is, you know, an off-brand. That seems to be okay, but not great. There's a lot of pros and cons between these things. The Zenith, so far, is the only one I see that you could turn on your TV and turn on your converter box from one remote control. That would drive little old ladies and little old men sitting around in an apartment somewhere nuts, because they'll have to use two controls for the other boxes. You can't program the remote. Not to mention the signal. The signal on the RCA was just a disaster. A lot of little dots on the screen. You could barely read the menu. And then when the picture came up, these same dots never disappeared. Almost like power line noise, but hard to describe what these dots look like. I don't know, some kind of interference or something. Let me drop it. I thought the RCA one might be good because that had a little, you know, transformer you could plug into the wall. So it came up with 9 volts DC. The other ones have power line cords going to it. My thought was, well, if the power goes out, you know, I could always, you know, hook up a 9-volt regulator, you know, hook up a 12-volt battery to it, and I'd be able to run it. Because when the power goes down, you know, you're not going to get anything, you know. You're not going to get the news or anything. So I thought that would be a good idea. But that was so terrible that I went back. So now I wound up with 2 boxes with line voltage cords. So the only way around that would be to get an inverter and hook that up to a battery, I guess. But just to look at the screen on some of these bad boxes, oh, it's terrible. And then, like the Apex, you can't even, there's no buttons you can't push on the front. Everything's done by the remote. Some have buttons on the front, some don't. So depending on the box, I think That's going to be part of the problem. Like Eric was saying, the receiver's got to be approved, but I mean, more than approved. I mean, they've got to come a long way. The Zenith is excellent. You know, it's got a good signal meter on it. You know, you can turn the antenna and see what you're doing. But the RCA really had nothing. I mean, it had something beep. So, I don't know, Dick. I think part of the problem is definitely these receivers. They've got to come up to snuff. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I can understand how...
Roy White.
Show recognized. I can understand how you were unhappy with some of the boxes because of the way the remote control works, the way the electronic product guide, or the EPG, I think it's called, the programming guide, the way that worked, and whatever, and dots on the screen, or not very much resolution, depending on how you connected it, either with the yellow, red, white wire, or two-channel three, but when it comes to real RF performance, how weak a signal, how many channels are there, was there still a huge difference in the number of channels that the box would respond to when connected to your antenna? That's my question first for you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I tried all three boxes on the same antenna. I bought a... amplified antenna, you know, it's got a little preamp in the antenna. Just, you know, grab the with a UHF hook to it as well, made by Philips. So I was able to make a good A, B, and really C test. The Zenith, there's got to be 20 different stations on there, you know, some from Connecticut and some from New York. Like channel 5 comes in good, channel 9, 3 of the 21s come in good. If I hold the antenna above my head, you know, about 3 feet above the TV, I could pick up all the three channel 13s that come in great. But I'd have to put a shelf up for that, as well as 11. So quite a few stations with the Zenith. With the RCA, I don't know. I think I got 7. That was it. With the exact same antenna, not moving anything. And with the Apex, I got about, I guess, 9. I think I remember 9 with that one. So, and the quality on the Apex, not really that good. There's definitely a difference in the strength of the pictures, too. The output of on that box is terrible. I would definitely go with the Zenith so far, which is really LG now. You know, Zenith and LG are the same. So that's my product review. Keep buying these things and bringing them back. Now, you got to remember, I have cable here, so I'm just playing around you know, with the idea that, well, you know, you have a backup. But I mean, I really don't need these, but... And then you're allowed 2 of them, so now I've got 2. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds like a fun set of experiments. To meet you, RYY, you got it, Joe.
Yeah, just I've been listening here for quite a while. I know you called me earlier. I went inside the building and I couldn't reply back on UHF. I didn't have VHF with me, so that was that. I did some experiment the other day with my Zenith, well, it's not necessarily Zenith Dakota, the Insignia, which is the same thing. And I wanted to see how much attenuation it took, and this is on a fairly good day, not too many clouds in the sky, nice bright sunny day, so I didn't have bad propagation, I had pretty good propagation. I wanted to see how many decibels of attenuation it took to make all the channels go away, or what would be remaining with the highest amount of attenuation. Feeding the converter, between the converter and the cable that feeds it off my antenna system, I got up to a figure of 13.9 decibels of attenuation. I'm using 75 ohm precision attenuators. So the last channels to come in on my system was channel 7 and channel 30. Those are the last ones that remained at 39 decibels of attenuation. Any more than that, and they disappeared. But the signal level meter on these on that box is very, very deceiving, because even at 30 decibels of attenuation, it still would indicate half to maybe 60% indication on the screen. So it really is not a signal level meter. It's more like you said earlier, it's like a bit level, a bit error level type of reading on these things. It fools you quite a bit as far as what you think it's actually doing. Because when I put originally, say, like 10 decibel attenuation, the meter hardly moved on any of the channels as far as the drop where it normally remained from, say, like 90 to 95% of the scale. So that's what I did recently, Dick. Back to you.
Interesting. Channel 30 is not one of them that I'm getting, I don't think. Is that a Connecticut station? You're aiming the antenna up north when you do that, Joe?
I don't have a rotor. I cannot aim the antenna any other way than it's aimed right now, which is right at Empire State Building. Channel 30 is one of the Spanish stations. I think it's 68, or you know, what you call 68 on the header. But it's actually RF Channel 30. It used to be occupied by Ion, which is now on 31. But that's the strongest signal. They're strong all the time. No matter what the weather is, the signal level hardly ever changes on that. I don't know where they're coming from, but they got a pretty good signal coming in. But I don't lose any of the channels in bad weather, even high rain like we've had in the past couple of days. I don't lose any of the channels. I don't have any kind of drop, but I guess I've got that much headroom in my system to allow for that.
That's coming from 4 times square. Okay, there is a channel 30 with a logo of 30, NBC affiliate, WVITDT, which really is on UHF 35. Is that the one we're talking about here, or is there another one? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, the one that you see is a 68. Now, this thing called PSIP actually lets you keep your branding. Remember, we had a discussion about that. But 30, which was actually 41, I think they have a, actually let me turn mine on and I'll tell you exactly which one is who. They had that 68 is also the same as the viewpoint E. It's actually take a viewpoint E. You'll see there's a channel that says 67. It's actually on 23. Let's see, what's on RF 30? Yeah. See what I got. 13, 17, 25. No, I don't see a digital 30. I go right from 31 is digital, 32 is analog, 34 is digital, 35 is analog, 38 is digital, 39 is analog. We're talking, I'm close in. I was off of 39 digital. That's, 39. That's NYN, right? Yeah. And then 41, which is XTV, I think they brand that to 41. So let me see what actually branded is 30. Yeah, 68 is FUT. That's coming off of 4 Times Square.
WSON, that's channel 30.
Yeah, FUT. Branded 68 is really 30, it's 33.6 miles from me, which sounds like it is a Times Square or Empire. I can't tell the difference between the two. Go ahead, Paul.
Hey, well, I got a 30.1. It's NBC WVIT. That comes out of Connecticut. And it's a 30.2, and that's also NBC. That's a weather channel the whole time. And there's a 30.3 as well. There's another NBC station. I think that's mostly sports, bicycle riding and things like that, diving, old shows from the Olympics. But they're all NBC affiliates. So if you really want to watch the equivalent of Channel 4 out of New York City, you can watch it on 30.1 NBC WVIT.
Yeah, that goes along with my list, which comes from Connecticut. I can tell it's 67 airline miles from me. It's probably up north. This particular chart I'm looking at doesn't have compass heading. To your knowledge, Eric, is there any other way I can get CBS television other than Real 33, Branding 20, Branding 2.1, but Real 33, which I'm getting very intermittently before I add the rotator. To your knowledge, is there any other way I can get CBS affiliate to KE2EJ, KQRIW?
Yeah, KQRIW, KE2EJ. By the way, if you go to antennaweb.org, it'll spit out, if you put in your zip code, it'll spit out what you can pick by pointing in different directions. One thing I wanted to mention is that most of the receivers actually respond to AGC at the RF section between like 0 and 40 or 50. At the point where the receiver is able to separate the sync word out of the stream, that's when it becomes error rate. The higher the numbers go, the less errors you have. The lower the numbers are, the more errors. So it is a cutoff point. Most of the displays display AGC up to a point, and then they switch over to bitrate. So that would be the case. But hang on, let me go to AntennaWeb and see what they say. Oh, by the way, you can pick up, you can watch 60 Minutes online if you really want to see it that badly. It's there at CBS.com.
That makes sense. That's what I should have done. And boy, do I need a rotator. Because there's a lot of things on my list that I'm holding on to. I'm not just... And by the way, Paul, when you talk about the channels 30.1, 30.2, and 30.3, from my point of view, they're all the exact same channel. So I think we should start counting the channel number, not the dash number. Because when you look at your field strength meter, you'll notice when you go to those dash numbers, they're all the same. They get the exact same field strength reading. Because you're looking at the exact same RF channel, you're just telling your converter to suck out the other program from that RF bitstream, if you know what I mean. Okay. Mel, do you think we should try to answer at least one mail tonight? It's your choice. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. We'll continue with questions I had last week that we started to talk about ZEP antenna. And one of the questions was, why do I, 25 feet of the twin lead is left as is and then goes up and then you separate it off. Why do you need twin lead when it seems like one side is going only up to the insulator and only a foot from there? Why is the two wires required? That was another question I had. There's a group of young people with looking to install ZEP antennas in some location over.
The twin lead, when you've got two wires side by side and you feed them differentially, in other words, at one instant of time, you make the right-hand wire positive and the left-hand wire negative, and the next half cycle the other way around. Even though on 600 ohm line, it looks like a huge separation between those two wires, believe it or not, that is a shielded structure. And properly used, very little radiation takes place from it. And when you peel away one of those wires at the top of that transmission line where you're beginning the ZEP antenna, now it is no longer a shielded structure. And it really starts radiating. In the case of a N-fed ZEP antenna, and the name represents the fact that it was first used in a popular manner on the Zeppelin blimps, it is an antenna that is some number of half wavelength long, to use it correctly. Some number of half wavelength long of the actual unshielded radiator section. And the impedance at that end fed is something like 1,000 ohms. So if you're starting off with 300 ohm or 600 ohm or 450 ohm twin lead, and you're feeding 1,000 ohm impedance, you only have a 2-to-1 or a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. And it's a pretty good antenna. If you fed it with coax, and not only is the coax going to be lossier, it's still a shielded structure, and you could stop the shield at that same point and use just the semiconductor of the coax. But the coax is a 50 ohm impedance on a 1,000 ohm antenna. That's a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. So for two reasons, the coax is going to behave poorly. Much higher standing wave ratio and considerably higher loss within the cable even before you count the high standing wave ratio. You put the two combinations together, lossier cable and super high 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, and that's going to be a fairly low performance antenna. I'm not saying it's not going to work. It's not going to work well. That's my feeling on that one, Mel. KQKEY, KQLAW.
Exactly, this is KQKEY. Let me describe an ideal ZEP antenna that I used and was very popular back in the 60s, the olden days. The antenna was, of course, 300 ohm twin lead was very easily obtainable in our days because the TV wire that was used on all the television antennas, and of course everybody had in those days a TV antenna outside. We were just discussing something that disappeared, and no, I don't have a TV antenna outside anymore. I have it in the attic. Believe it or not, I'm receiving everything that I imagine, more than I really need here, where I'm approximately, I think, 17 miles from the Empire State Building, and I'm getting all great reception, so very happy for that, and that's about all we need, because not much in the way of TV watches here. Let me let it drop for a second. Now, in our day, as I was saying, that because 300 ohm wire was so common, so cheap, and all, that the ZEP antenna was very popular with new hands at the time, novices back in the 50s. And all I did was took a piece of the twin lead, 300 ohm twin lead wire, ran it up there to an insulator, and then had a flat top. That means from after I separated it off up there with an insulator, one was 135 feet of straight wire, and that was the antenna I used very successfully on 80 through 10 meters. 80 through 10 meters, it worked extremely well. Very, very simple antenna, and in fact, you can make it into a number, doesn't have to be straight 135. You can make it into a sort of, you know, a number of set ways, loafers or L's or whatever, but this was the method of feeding it very simply with this wire, that 300 ohm wire. And as Dick said, it became popular, I guess, back in the 30s when it was used on the Zeppelin airship. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, one piece of 135-foot long wire is half wave on 80 meters. Full wave on 40 meters. Let me think now. I think it's two wavelengths on 20 meters. Four wavelengths on 10 meters. Not quite sure what it is on 15, but we'll eventually figure that one out. So it is some number of half wavelengths on every one of those bands. The pattern is going to get a little bit more complicated as you go up in frequency, but the impedance match is going to be quite good on all of those. So it's a fairly simple antenna with reasonably high performance. Roughly how many feet above the ground did you mount it on, Mel? And did you use it on every one of those bands, including 15 meters, with or without an antenna tuner? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Yeah, Roger. Well, it wasn't very high up. I guess that house was maybe 25 feet up. I remember it was connected one end, was hanging on a clothesline pole. And the other end went somewhere out there, I think to a tree limb somewhere out front. I think, if I remember, twisted around this way or that way. And I used it, let's see, I was mostly on 80 and 40 with that rig. It was a homebrew radio, of course. I had, the way I matched it to it, I did not have any tuner or anything. My original setup there as an office was just a very simple radio, that simple transmitter that used a 6L6 in the final, and I think I had an oscillator. The original one was just a 6L6 crystal exciter, 6L6, and then I think I branched off. I made another version of it. That original one was the one from the ARL book, you know, how to get on the air, one tube built onto a wooden chassis. And then later on, I think they built the more advanced rig, which was a three-tuber, you know, with a 5U4 and a 6A2 what was the 6AC7, I think, or G7 oscillator, and then the 606 final dick. But it all used link coupling for the antenna system, the antenna coupling system, with a variable capacitor over.
Six? Yeah, go ahead.
Hello?
The only other CBS station you can pick is in Hartford. It's on 33, so you need a motor. But you'll probably be able to get it.
Oh, yeah. I used to get Channel 8 from Connecticut off the leakage on my cable that went to the antenna on the chimney, on the tower, way off to the side. So at the time I put a rotator on the roof, and eventually an antenna with a rotator on the tower.
Yeah, the ERP is a megawatt, and the antenna is at 288.8 meters.
That's above mean sea level or above ground level?
It's height above average terrain.
Beautiful. H-A-A-T. Which I think is done by taking every tenth of a mile from 0 to 10 miles in about, 8 or 16 compass directions. Is that the way they derive H-A-A-T?
It's just kind of convoluted. It's like Langley Rice, it's kind of convoluted.
Have you ever seen that plotting program called SPLAT, S-P-L-A-T?
Yeah, I read this month, QEX.
Okay. As you know, we talked to the author of that, KD2BD, from time to time. John, looks like he did a pretty nice job there. It looks like it's being used by a lot of areas. You go to that website, and you'll see some beautiful demonstrations of what it can do in plotting grade A and grade B broadcast areas, and repeater coverage areas, and so on. And I think it uses the main geodetic survey altitude raw material for its database. I think that's the source of the database. Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, I'm looking on the FCC website. I can even see the pattern. So, yeah, that flat is interesting. It's, you know, it's a way for guys like you and me to get access. But there's a couple of Langley Rice programs that you can actually download, and you know, the software's gotten a lot better. There's also a couple of sites where they can use their big computers and calculate it for you.
I think SPLAT is freeware. And we've got 1 minute left, Eric. No. for the guys who have hung in there this long, this was TechNet number 1,252 of the series that began in September of 1982. We're coming up to our 27th year. Boy, these guys have got perseverance. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. We'll be back next week, and we'll settle some of these antenna issues. Some of them. We'll never settle all of them. So hang in there. There's more to come. Mel, K2KEY, you got it. K2RIW.
Just going to say goodnight to all, and thank you very much for joining us, and we'll try, as Dick says, to do it again next week. Take care, everybody. 73. This is K2KEY.
Say goodnight, Gracie.
Goodnight, this is Calabash, wherever you are. Yeah, say goodnight, Gracie.
K22DUX, goodnight, Gracie.
What's the name of the man who would say that?
George Burns.
Give that man a cigar.
Cigar will make me live to 100.
He would have made it if he didn't fall in his bathtub. He needed more anti-slip devices in his bathtub. He hit his head on the side of the porcelain, and that's what really did him, in my opinion.
I think he died at 103 months, didn't he? Or 3 months shy.
Yeah, but he wasn't as healthy at the end. He intended to play the palladium or whatever on his 100th birthday. And until he fell in his bathtub, he was very healthy and doing very well. He could quote all of the lyrics of all of those songs that were popular back then.
12 a.m., 7:03, and good night from...
Hey, Jeff.
He could quote all of the songs that were popular in 1910.
Hey,
30.
W7R18 didn't check in tonight. He said he might. You know him, Dick?